Raquel and this is Wendy, and we're part of the Scarlet Tide Brigade. This is a collective of women who are an action group at SF PERC. We focus on women's issues in general and women's health, especially menstruation. We're here today with Dr. Liz Philippos, who is the Ruth Wynn Woodward Chair in the Women's Studies Department at SFU. She's been here since September and has taught two courses so far. She's taught, last semester was Feminist Theory, and this semester it's Feminism and International Human Rights. She's visiting us from California State University, and we're here to talk about international human rights in the context of women. Can we talk a little bit about how women's issues have made their way into the UN?
Sure. As I will always say, women's issues don't get onto anyone's agenda without the long, hard struggle of feminists and women's organizations to make that an issue. The concept of women's rights has been sort of codified in things like the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, known as CEDAW, and that's a convention in the human rights system that's existed since, I believe, 1979 or so. It's a document, basically, it's a treaty that states would agree to when they agree to it. They put the treaty into their domestic legal system, so it becomes part of domestic law. And the Convention on Women basically takes all of the provisions of other human rights codes, so the covenant on economic, social, or cultural rights, for instance. It'll take rights out of that document, rights out of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, for instance, and gathered it in CEDAW with a specific focus on women and girls. So it was with the recognition that women in any state, in any country, exist under different conditions than the male population, and also a recognition that in any state, in any country, women and girls exist in unequal relationships to men. That's kind of amazing, too, out of billions of people on Earth. Everyone agrees women are less than men. So you needed some kind of body of law that would address gender-specific conditions of women's lives to make those other human rights principles relevant. So, for instance, in the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, there's a provision that says everyone has the right to an adequate standard of living. In that provision, the assumption is that you are able to go outside the home and work in paid employment. But for women, that's often not the reality. Most of women's work, the majority of it, is unpaid. It's usually domestic or domestic agricultural, but the services to family or the community. This is not something that you can do on the side while you also have paid employment. And so we refer to things like the double day or the triple day or things like that, meaning that women, by the fact that they are women, are not in a position to access an adequate standard of living unless you create conditions that equalize women's lives, particularly taking the slack off unpaid work. So it's an example, right, of having to translate an adequate standard of living, which seems like a neutral sort of provision, to be gender-specific and applied to women. Did I answer the question?
Yes.
When I talk about women's organizations, right, mm-hmm. at the UN, or sort of women's struggles to get gender-specific issues on the agenda, they're not through official channels, right? So, you know, who makes decisions about covenants and conventions and things are leaders of states, diplomats, negotiators, etc., right? So from Canada, for instance, it's bureaucrats from the Department of Foreign Affairs that attends global meetings, right, and negotiates on behalf of Canada. So these aren't necessarily feminists, and they're not necessarily women in lots of instances. It's the sort of informal influence, though, and the domestic lobbying that women's groups do that kind of force countries to support something like a women's convention, ultimately. We have to say, too, though, that there's something about women's rights that gets used politically for reasons other than serving women's interests. So, for instance, to look good diplomatically, state leaders always turn to women's rights and always sort of publicly concern themselves with the welfare of women in their countries and abroad. Now, we know that this is insincere because we can just look at the condition of women living around the world and say that, yeah, if it was sincere, something would change. So they're just using it politically. CEDAW is the most widely subscribed convention in the human rights system. Something like 180 states out of 191 have agreed to the provisions of CEDAW. So you would think that women's rights are a hot topic and women are on the ascendancy. But this is all about sort of representing yourself in the international sphere as civilized. Canada loves to talk about sort of the work it does on behalf of women in other parts of the world as part of its image of being a civilized and humanitarian nation. And countries inside the UN and the General Assembly, for instance, will sort of influence each other, kind of raise women's rights as something that, of course, we support, or of course you would support. So it's a mixed bag when we're talking about the sort of publicity around women's rights. Nonetheless, right, this informal NGO social movement struggle that people wage within their countries and women's groups wage within their countries is important to have that, get that dialogue into the international sphere. There's a number of women's groups right now whose primary focus is on strengthening the provisions of the CEDAW Convention. And one of the things that they're trying to do is get an optional protocol attached to CEDAW. An optional protocol is a mechanism that allows individuals to make complaints through that treaty. So, for instance, Canada's ratified CEDAW, a subscriber to the convention, and if we had an optional protocol and my rights are being violated and Canadian law won't address it, I can go through that optional protocol straight to the UN and demand some kind of compensation. So for a lot of women's groups, particularly, these are women who have a kind of intimate knowledge of the way international law works, they see the optional protocol to CETA as a very important site of struggle to make that convention more implementable, if that's a word. Otherwise, sort of, you know, individuals can't really make complaints through it and can't get compensation, NGOs and social movements can put reports in through the CEDAW Convention and hold their governments accountable at another level. So that it's all to say that these are also rolling documents or living documents. I think lawyers will talk like that sometimes. And that there is a progressive development of law that happens through interpretation, through specific cases, through the gathering of more and more information. So there's always activism around CEDAW in particular. We should say, too, that there's always women's activism around all of the bodies of the United Nations human rights system through world conferences like the World Conference on Women that happened several times, but the last one in 1995 in Beijing. And there's been a 5-year review of that and a 10-year review of that. Women's organizations were very active in the World Conference Against Racism in 2001, held in South Africa, and had a separate women's tribunal where they heard about sort of individual cases of racial and gender oppression that they were documenting and seeking redress. There's the Commission on Human Rights that meets every year for about 6 or 8 weeks in Geneva, where tons of women's organizations participate. And there's also the Commission on the Status of Women that meets every year around this time, I think. Yeah, March or April. And same thing, you know, a lot of organizations gather to participate in those meetings. So it's an ongoing, at the UN anyways, ongoing involvement of feminist and women's NGOs to keep these documents rolling forward, we'll say, and to keep issues on the table. Even though there's all these mechanisms for women's rights, there is always a threat that they'll be removed from the table, particularly as issues of sexual health and rights, reproductive health and rights, gets on. There are a number of countries that will never, ever agree to provisions around sexual and reproductive health and rights, including the U.S., for instance. But so these are always sort of, there's always a danger, too, that anything that's been gained through these mechanisms is could disappear just as easily, depending on the climate and the mood. I'll say that the climate and the mood is very, very bad right now for women internationally.
Can you talk about the process that specific issues are addressed in the U.N.? For example, the sexual and reproductive health, how does that come into the discourse within the UN, that or violence or property rights? Or...
Okay. Well, on sexual and reproductive health and rights, this is it's a big phrase. It's meant to cover a lot of things, right? It's meant to cover everything from, well, we could say in general, it's the freedom over your own body. So whatever that includes or involves. The UN has been able to sort of stomach the idea that reproductive health is an issue and that we need to fund clinics better and fund sort of women's health care better so that you can reduce things like maternal mortality rates or maternal morbidity rates or premature births or anything sort of health-related, related to maternity, largely. So seeing women as mothers is something the UN and governments are pretty comfortable with. It's when you add reproductive rights that starts to become a problem, of course, in so many places where abortion rights are denied or seen to be sinful or however it is that they're characterized illegal. And when you add then sexual rights, you're talking about the right of women to not marry men, the right of women to be lesbians, to be queer, to have autonomy over their sexual lives. That is a triple problem for many countries, many people. I would say men in general, if I could be so bold. You could edit that if you want. And so one of the strongest statements on women's sexual and reproductive health rights, I don't think, were central, came from the Cairo meetings of it was the World Conference on Population and Development. And that was, I believe, in, I said I was bad at dates, 93, somewhere around there. It's the provision that a lot of advocacy groups have taken up and tried to use in their own countries to lobby governments to expand sort of the freedoms that women have over repro and sexual rights, or health, sorry. That statement sort of got rolled into the Beijing Platform for Action in 95, and so that got expanded to centralize more the idea of rights. And it was, if you talk to women who negotiated for Beijing or lobbied their governments around Beijing, they'll say that it was, you know, a lot of effort and a lot of work and some amount of fluke that they got such strong language in the Platform for Action. And that remains contentious since 95. And in fact, a number of countries have said that even though we agreed to the provisions at Cairo, we take it back. And that wasn't what we meant, and et cetera. So this remains a contest. There's been a huge growth of right-wing, religious-based organizations lobbying at the UN. There's always been sort of the Vatican has always had a seat, the Holy See, and it's not a voting seat, but it is a seat in the UN where they used to influence and lobby. And often the Holy See will sponsor organizations to come, NGOs and such, to come and lobby with them on certain things. That has grown, though, far beyond the Holy See. And so, for instance, the last time I was at the UN in women's meetings was Beijing Plus Five, the 5-year review. And you would go into the gallery where NGOs are allowed to be to watch governments negotiate, and it would be full of men in suits from these religious organizations, mostly North American-based organizations funded to be there. You know, it's rare. Prior to that, you would see a gallery full of men arrive for a women's meeting. And they were very much focused on rolling back sexual and reproductive rights and health at the five-year review. There was even, a kind of active harassment of out lesbians, for instance. So it would happen that one of the women that I know is walking out of the cafeteria and suddenly she's surrounded by all of these people on their knees praying for her soul. Or it happened that after an afternoon of debates about sexual and reproductive rights and health between governments, that a group of religious organizations, Christian-based organizations, went into the room and did an exorcism to remove the sort of, toxins and poisons they felt had been let out in the room. So this is a very intimidating environment, to say the least, and really a very, you know, kind of scary concerted effort to make sure that women don't have this autonomy, even on paper, right? Because we're just talking about, first of all, agreements. So it's even a first basic step. What else can I say about that? Oh, right. The other thing to sort of note about sexual and reproductive health and rights is that, like, what gets focused on is that, oh, this is letting women, you know, have abortions on demand, that language people use, or letting women, you know, sleep with whoever they want or whatever, which I don't see what the problem is there. But the fact is that that is a category that does cover things like having adequate nutrition when you're pregnant so that you can have a healthy birth, right? Or that you can live while you give birth or things like that. So it's also it's an attack on what people see as sort of the sensational aspects of women's freedom or women's demands. But really, you know, there's also some very basic needs that get denied by that assault on sexual and reproductive health and rights.
Do you think that that intimidating environment that you're talking about actually works to hamper the efforts of women's groups?
Well, you know, those fora between NGOs, social movements, and governments are all about filling the air with language. You know, it's all about a kind of intangible influence that you're wielding. And so publicity for your position, getting everybody to say your words or, you know, have flyers with a slogan that you get everyone to talk about, things like that really matter, right? So when you start to have increasingly critical masses of people coming to women's rights meetings who are fundamentally against women's rights, filling the air with another kind of language, you know, it's an intangible influence that happens, and it encourages governments who would rather go a more conservative route. You know, it tips the balance often. So, like, if you have a gallery full of very progressive feminists, right, you can tip the balance the other way by filling the air with your language and your concepts. And it's a kind of interesting thing to watch, you know, how, you know, one NGO will make a speech, like you've heard the phrase, women's rights are human rights. This is from a speech, I think, that Charlotte Bunch, she's from the Center for Women's Global Leadership, made in 1993 at the Vienna World Conference on Human Rights. She said that, and they thought about that, like they're savvy about marketing, but, you know, that has become kind of a global claim, right, that people make. And so it tipped the balance, let's say, from a position that was unclear that human rights needed to be gender specific to the other side where you just, you know, you say women's rights are human rights means you have to make these gender specific. So it kind of works like that, right? When you see a critical mass of anti-women's rights people, it doesn't intimidate us personally, I don't think, but it changes the climate.
Can you talk a little bit about how the issue of domestic violence against women ended up in Vienna in 1993?
Well, domestic violence, should say, remains controversial as an international human rights issue. But there were a number of women's organizations, domestic women's organizations, who frustrated, right, with the lack of state response to the incidents of domestic violence, wanted to put this in the international fora as a violation of women's rights, and specifically women's right to be free from violence, which is a standard neutral human right, women's right to life, and all of the other things that are affected by patterned domestic violence. And so a number of organizations got together prior to the Vienna World Conference on Human Rights in 93, and this was about a two-year process of, they wanted to hold a tribunal, which is, you know, a semi-official legal kind of body to develop case law. If you're a lawyer, you know that case law really matters in domestic issues. That's where you get precedent from. That's where you get interpretations from. In international fora, that you don't really have big bodies of case law, and so you have to be creating those bodies through informal mechanisms. So that's what that tribunal was about at Vienna. And one of the intentions of that Vienna tribunal was to gather women from a number of national contexts who could speak to several categories of violence that happens to women because they are women, so gender-specific violence. So one level was for women to speak to state-based violence, so violence that is done to women by the military, by police in wartime, by informal soldiers, etc. And another category of violence that they wanted to address was violence done by non-state actors, normally considered to be private violence, but with the complicity of state, so some kind of official complicity. And that's either passive or active complicity. So in the case of domestic violence, for instance, feminists will argue that if you have, you know, and the rates, depending on reporting, depending on the country, or something like from 30% to 90% of all women have experienced domestic violence, depending where you look, that feminists will argue that that speaks to patterned and systemic violations against women that cannot be attributed simply to individual men's failures or criminalities or etc. That this is actually, even though it is domestic and between intimate partners, it is a matter of public violation of women's rights because it's a failure on the part of states to create a climate in which that is not possible. Right? And it's a failure on the part of states to create provisions where women who are victimized by domestic violence are forced to remain in those circumstances because of economic inequality, because of being seen as property or extensions of their husbands in different ways. And so domestic violence was put onto the international table as a public violation of women's rights. And that was a very important move to make because at Vienna and through that Vienna tribunal, I think that the women's groups were very successful in making the link between domestic and public violence and other state forms of violence. And they were also successful to get mechanisms like the Declaration Against Violence Against Women and the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women to also acknowledge, you know, that domestic violence should always be part of the picture that you're creating when talking about violence against women. So can I talk about, like, what I think is the most pressing issue for global feminists? Okay. Usually human rights or these human rights fora are, they tend to be seen kind of separate from other kinds of international politics, right? So people will work through the UN or through their NGOs or whatever and not connect kind of human rights with other global issues or geopolitical circumstances. And it seems to me that one of the most pressing issues that has everything to do with where women are, where men are, where we all are systemically, is in our relationship to militarism and to war. And what's been sort of startling, I think, since the beginning of the war in Afghanistan initially, and then the war in Iraq that continues, in which we're all complicit, even though Canada said we're not going, somehow we're there. We have funds, we have peacekeepers, we have a relationship to this militarism, and we benefit from it in many different ways. The fact is that this is something that should, I think, involve feminists in every sort of level of commentary. These sorts of wars at this moment in time are really opening up a lot of what we've held sacred or haven't thought about for a while. So we've taken things like democracy for granted, or taken things like, yeah, we live in capitalism, for granted, or however it is we've formulated it. And this war in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places that we're going to go shortly has everything to do with kind of the failures of our capitalist system, first of all, and our utter dependence on things that we ultimately will have little control over. That's natural resources. And so there's a kind of sea change, I think, going on. And when I go to peace rallies or conferences or whatever that are talking about the current state of militarism, it's rare that I'm hearing feminists talking from a gender perspective about how we ought to understand the world. But more importantly, what I think feminists are so amazing at is imagining what different worlds could look like. And now more than ever, it seems like this is the work that we ought to be doing from not just a gender perspective, but also an anti-colonial or anti-racist perspective. Because this too, you know, there's been times previous where it's been a lot easier to say, well, yeah, some people are racist, but it's not that big a deal. But I think since 2001, we're hard-pressed to not notice that everything we hear comes to us through colonial categories and racist perceptions. And feminists have done an awful lot of work, I think, on developing anti-colonial perspectives from gender, and trying to imagine what equity and social justice looks like for all people. And so this is the time, I think, where we have to work harder and be smarter in how we imagine what comes next, because there's a ton of different interests looking to capitalize on what comes next, and it won't be in the service of social justice. So that's what I think is the most pressing issues for feminists today.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Dr. Philippos. If you'd like more information about the Scarlet Tide Brigade, you can email us at stb@sfperg.ca. Again, that's stb@sfperg.ca. So thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.